This time of year, many of us find ourselves wishing we had a new deck or porch. Today, our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, will give you the tools to make that wish come true. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, I'll talk about decks, porches, and patios with Bill McAnally. Building a deck is not quite as simple as buying a load of lumber and roping in your brother-in-law to help. Bill will tell us how to get started and how to do it right. He'll also answer your questions about the things that are falling apart in your house or home improvement projects that you're planning for the summer. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Once the rain stops, it will be time to fire up the grill and spend a lot of time outside. Wouldn't it be nice to do that with a new deck? Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today to give us some advice if building a new deck or porch or fixing the one you have is on your agenda, although he looks pretty confused and he's rifling through a lot of papers, so maybe he can't help us at all. Hello, Bill.
You think I'd find one that didn't have something on it so I could write on?
Here's a pad of paper.
I can use my bald spot, but it's on the backside. Okay.
All right. So first of all, if I think, you know, I'd like a new deck, but I don't want to pay anybody to do it. Can I build my own deck? What skills do I need to have to be able to be successful?
It really isn't that hard. I mean, it isn't. You know, when you look at all the things that we can do brand new, usually a deck is pretty simple. But you know, when we look back at some of the things that that we used to do, that's me, builders, in the past, you know, in the 70s, it was like, well, how do we hold this deck on the side of the house? You know, you just get the biggest nails that let's go down to Beiser Lumber. Let's see what we're going to get, you know, and we'd just use huge nails. And then we'd see that when we'd replace it, that all the problems that we caused and driving down the road, you know, I'll always look at new homes and look at their decks. And you've probably seen the same thing. You're looking at these decks on the backside of a house and they're sitting on these little spindly little 4x4s. And it seems like they're 12 feet in the air. And you're thinking, how in the world are those things going to, you know, hold that whole deck up? And, you know, if you just, you know, do your research on how to frame it, you know, there's all these options on what to put on the deck. The most important thing is the framework that's actually going to hold all you and your friends. And, you know, if somebody gets half tanked, they're up there wrestling around. You never know what's going to happen up on a deck. So you want to build that thing actually stronger than the floor to your house.
Really?
Yes. And in some jurisdictions, it is supposed to be built stronger than the floor to your house as far as loads.
All right. So you think I have the skills to do this?
Yes, you do. I know
right.
You do.
Uh-huh. Let's say I want to get started. I obviously need a good plan.
Yep.
And I need to know what the code is, right?
Right.
Okay. So where do I go to find this information?
Well, we did post that today as a link.
On our Facebook page, you can find the code, and it's a lot of gobbledygook.
A lot of pictures. A lot of pictures, though.
All right.
You know, it's a prescriptive residential wood deck construction guide, and really all it is, and I really like the layout that they have. It's based on the 2009 residential codes, which most communities have, and really everybody should be following anyway. And remember, codes are minimums. So if you got really big friends, you overbuild the deck, okay? But it tells you, you know, what kind of lumber to use. So that when you go to, say, a lumber yard or a supply store, when you look through the chart, you realize that, you know, there maybe the lumber is really cheap, or I should say inexpensive, but it may not be the type of species that you think you can go from point A to point B. That is your span. So if you hook it to your house and you don't want to have a whole lot of posts supporting this thing because maybe you're underneath it, you know, another patio area, that's where you have to do your research because some species cannot span the distance you may want to go.
All right. So you need to know if you're getting southern pine or Douglas fir or redwood.
Wow, that's right off the top of your head. That's pretty good. Yeah. You want to know all of that. And then if you're using treated lumber, we've learned that there's a lot of corrosion that's going on between certain fasteners and a lot of the products like hangers. You'd set your floor joist into a hanger. And if you don't have the right hanger for the type of, say, treated lumber and the right fasteners and the right length to put, you know, on those joists, then you may have failures as well. But I think the biggest thing right now, the biggest change is how we're attaching to the house. And that's one thing. If you're going to do it yourself, that's probably the biggest issue for you is if you're going to think that you can just go ahead and attach it through your vinyl siding or steel siding, that's not going to happen. And then if it's a fairly recently built home, we're using a lot of products like they call them I-joists. They're made of oriented strand board, and they're products that we can't get wet. I mean, they just can't handle moisture. And if you don't detail where the deck meets the house properly, it's just a nightmare for water getting behind siding and taking the deck out. And just imagine when you're going down the road and you see these decks, you know, sticking out from the house and maybe a couple little posts underneath them. If they can wobble left or right just a little bit, you know, then you realize that could just every once in a while just keep pulling on the house, pulling right. the house.
So you're putting a lot of stress on the house, the siding. You could be creating a lot of damage.
And actually, the deck can fall away.
All right. How do you connect them?
Well, I'm kind of going with some of the newer technologies. In fact, we're going to be doing one here in about 3 weeks. We're not going to attach them to the house anymore. We're actually having the deck separate. So what you're doing is you are going all the way to the footing that carries the house. Okay, we've always kind of sometimes put posts in disturbed soil and then the thing moves around and frost takes it, moves around. But where it goes up against the house, we're going all the way down to the footing and then coming up from there with either steel or concrete to ground level. And then the deck will have posts right up against the house. And then all you're probably going to have is maybe a half-inch space between the siding and the deck and a couple of bolts just to keep it from pulling away a little bit to go through. But we're not having that huge chunk of siding missing. And then where the deck can hold moisture in there and water can always take out the wood. And so we're starting to see a lot more people do that. The one that we're doing, we're not looking at wooden posts. We're going to have good concrete footings and then steel posts come up and hold the deck. And people will say, well, that costs too much. Well, do you want something that's going to last, you know, a long time, or do you want to do something that's just temporary? And it's just better to overbuild something that you know, could possibly have a lot more people in that area, you know, because when you think of decks, you know, as well as they're used, you tend to have a lot more people there than what you may have in, say, your living room. About the only time you have that many people in your living room is if it's a birthday or Thanksgiving or something. But on a deck,
you often have large groups on your deck.
You often have large groups out there. And, you know, that's why you have to be careful about how much can they move back and forth. And so when you see these spindly posts come up, I just cringe when I don't see bracing going from the post to the deck to help keep some of that wobble from going back and forth.
So this may be a weekend project, but build it to last.
Yeah, build it to last. So it's going to, you know, you're going to probably spend one weekend getting the footings right, the next weekend doing the framing, the next weekend maybe doing the decking and all that. But if you actually follow like that prescriptive guide and do your research and I really, you know, most homeowners can handle that, especially if they get some help from, you know, like, say, local lumber yards. A lot of times there's somebody there that can really help you out. And you do see a lot of good things, like, say, on Howe's. You know, we have that on iPad. It's got all kinds of pictures. And a lot of times they'll have some good articles as well. But just do a lot of research, especially on the construction side. There's been a lot of changes on the decking, you know, what products to use. I like wood, like cedar. I don't like treated wood because I don't want the kids, you know, crawling out there, getting their hands in it. But we're starting to see better generation, I think, of the composites where there's wood and then plastic or whatever, and then some of the all plastics and the vinyls. We're getting better generations of those. But I think what people have to remember is they will fade. You know, they're usually – and they're hard to replace sometimes, especially the vinyl ones if they're interlocking. But then the darker colors, if you have on the west side of your deck or west side of your house, a lot of times they get so hot you can't go out there in your bare feet. And that's kind of one of the downsides of some of the synthetic ones. The wood really never gets that hot. You can't walk on it. But some of the newer man-made ones get pretty doggone hot.
So if you – let's say you build with wood – and you get the framing right, you build mm-hmm. something that is going to be part of the structure of your house for a very long time, what do you need to do to finish it to make sure that the wood doesn't rot, especially if you're using untreated wood?
If you use, you know, like, say, cedar, you know, that's where you want to go to, like, say, something that's not just topical, something that, well, like an oil that actually gets into the wood. And you are going to have maintenance. I mean, that's the thing. But what we've learned, too, is where a lot of the maintenance issues occur is where the decking itself sits on the floor joists. So what you want to do, and it's not hard to find, is there's some products called like Vicor and York Wrap. They make this kind of an adhesive tape, a thick, like a waterproofing tape, that goes over the top of the floor joists themselves. So when you put the deck on top of it, that it helps seal where the nails go into the wood, so you don't get water rotting then the top of the floor joists out. Because even treated lumber, that's the thing, is everybody thinks, okay, that's going to last forever. Well, treated lumber, green treated lumber, when you put fasteners into it, we're seeing fasteners corrode completely away in, you know, 5 to 7 years. It just depends on what fastener they used and how much treatment is in the wood, because there's copper in that wood, and when it gets wet and mixes with galvanizing, you get electrolysis basically and corrosion. But when you use these tapes, it cuts down the amount of moisture that goes into the deck, and just putting the tape on top of those joists and keeping water away from the fasteners, you know, you may get three times the life out of your deck. But, you know, when you're looking at the flooring, there again, you want to look at what type of fasteners are holding it down. You'll see maybe in magazines and that, they have these little clips and they go into the sides. And a lot of those are pretty nice because you can't see the fastener, and so that it's in the edges. And some of the newer systems are really pretty neat because they've realized that having a fastener come down from the top, you're creating a little hole in the top of whatever it is, and then water is just going to travel right down and take out the wood.
Now, we shared the code on our Facebook page.
Sure.
Is this something that home inspectors really look at? If you have a home inspector come before somebody else buys your house and your deck isn't up to code, is that
yes.
going to be a problem?
Yes, it is. Well, we did one in Cedar Falls a few years ago, and the inspector there was great because he came out, he inspected the footings first, and then he inspected the framing, and then he said, okay, now you can put the decking on. And then he came out and he said, now I want to make sure this handrail is like this, this, this. Then he came back and gave his blessing. You know, when people think, okay, I don't even need to get a permit. Well, you need to get a permit for a deck, and because it is structural. And a good inspector, yes, will tell you exactly what you need to do. And go to them first. They'll help you. I mean, they're not the enemy. They will help you design a deck. Or not design it, but they'll tell you what you need to do.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment, and Bill will answer your questions, deck-related or otherwise. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Home improvement expert Bill McAnally is here today. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally, is here today. And we've been talking about decks, but of course, Bill can answer your questions about any of the things that are falling apart in your home, any home improvement projects you have on the horizon. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also post your questions on our Facebook page. And if you are getting serious about building a deck, you can take a look at that code that we were talking about a few minutes ago. Now let's get to the phones. And Matthew is on the line in Iowa City. Hello, Matthew.
Hello.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, a house in Iowa City is from 1923, and the porch hasn't had any real repairs onto it since probably forever. There's been some coats of paint on the floor, on the flooring and on the banisters and the under ceiling and things like that. But, and we have done some of that ourselves, but the columns and some of the posts, which are some, not necessarily structural, it's not dangerous, but still some issues since it is original and has seen many seasons. So we're planning on doing some work on it, but not quite sure if we should try to repair it, according to the, just repair what's there, fill in with some wood, maybe add some dry rot, or fully, or just replace, I suppose, the wood with either modern wood or composite. And whether how much of that we could do ourselves.
You know, porches, that's a good question, man, because porches sometimes they're so much more complex than a deck, because we have the roof, we have usually some sort of a foundation. And, some of the older ones, they would tend to slope the floor so that, they were originally built open, so most of them were, so that the water would go away. And over the years, we've tended to maybe close them in or add siding and cut off where the water would flow. And we don't know how much of the foundation settled, and that's why a lot of times the roofs are starting to kind of fall away from the house a little bit. And so then when they do that, water comes in and maybe go across the ceiling wood and then come down the columns. So, I would recommend that you get somebody on a porch that has quite a bit of an experience, a really good contractor that knows how he can temporarily support that roof or possibly get it back to where it was originally, maybe level. And there are some really good composite type columns now that I was just looking at one the other day. It was 8 inches by 8 inches, and it can carry 12,000 pounds. So you may want to keep what you have, but I would have somebody come in before they start working and temporarily support that roof, because when you never know how much pressure there is maybe on the wood you're looking at. Never tear anything apart, like say on the columns or the foundation, unless you have that roof braced up so that it can't come down in case something does happen, because you never know, there might be just one little thing just holding everything together, and this is a chance where you can probably redo the foundation. I don't know how far you want to go with it, but
I think the foundation is structurally okay. And the roof doesn't seem to be coming off the side of the house either.
Okay.
It's really more the columns that are showing some signs of, the bearing ones are okay. The low bearing ones seem okay. They might, have, of course, suffered from time.
Okay.
And weather. So I don't think it might not be that extensive, but yes, okay. I would definitely support it. Now, as far as finding a contractor, what type of, search terms, or what kind of, is there an expertise that we should be looking for?
Usually you look for someone that does a lot of remodeling, specializes in remodeling. New construction, a lot of times, if they've only done new construction, they haven't maybe got into some of the issues that you may run into in yours. I would go to, your local lumberyard, and a lot of times they will be able to recommend someone that has good experience in it. A lot of the times they have their business cards left off, and when a lumberyard recommend someone, they're kind of putting their reputation on the line as well. So a lot of times, smaller lumber yards kind of tend to know maybe somebody that specializes a little bit more. But, you can go ahead and get some of the newer, epoxies. And if you're lucky, if it is just, kind of topical, the epoxies, wood epoxies, you may be able to bring it right back to life and it'll look great. I'm hoping that's what it is, because if it's the structural ones that you say are good, that's the part that I was worried about for you.
All right.
Yeah, but, just kind of check your local lumberyard and building inspectors as well. A lot of times they'll be able to tell you who knows how to do those kind of things.
All right, Mathieu, thank you very much for your call. Here's an email from Mike. Hi, I had my deck rebuilt last fall and would like to roof part of it over and screen it in, eventually making it into a three-season porch with windows. Is it okay to do it in steps like this, or should I just bite the bullet and do the three-season now?
Well, if you just put a deck, and then now that you're going to attach a roof or walls to the house, you have to have it all with footings. Maybe your deck was just setting there, and it was just designed to hold the deck. You're going to add a tremendous amount of load with the roof and the sidewalls. Most jurisdictions will probably make, unless you somebody really was thinking when they built the deck, most jurisdictions would probably have you take that deck off and start all over again if you're going to make a three seasons porch out of it, because they know that three seasons sometimes turn into four seasons, and then you're getting into heating issues, cooling issues. But when you tie a roof in, that whatever ties in and holds that roof up has to be down to something structural, basically the equivalent of in Iowa, mostly 4 feet in the ground. And you're going to probably, if you're in a town, you're going to have a set of drawings to take to the city, because most of the time they won't let you do that.
All right. Next up, Carla is on the line in Oxford. Hello, Carla.
Hi. I guess I'm starting to get scared already.
That's my job.
Well, I have just a small, simple, ordinary deck, only a few feet off the ground, only 4 years old. But it's been a disaster because it faces west, and when it's warm out, it's about 20 degrees hotter than the actual temperature, like.
Sure.
Or it's always wet, or it's got snow on it, and the roof is metal, so that condensation runs off the roof onto the deck. So in other words, it's a very unpleasant place, and in order to keep it from being a complete waste of money, I would like to extend the roof over the deck and maybe partially enclose it. No heating or cooling, just very simple, some protection from the elements.
Okay. Sometimes they will allow you to tie a roof, something like that, into a house.
I live on a farm. Okay. I don't live in town.
But still, we want to do the right thing. Because there's reasons for doing that. Let's say you attach a roof to from the deck onto your house, even though you're not in a town where they would make you do something. You don't want that deck raising up on the outside, because if it isn't in the ground 4 feet, the frost may raise that, and then what it'll do is it'll push that steel roof into the roof that you have, and it could possibly crumple it, bend it or snap it. And that's why there are codes like that. But there's other ways to handle that. I know what some people have done is they've put shading over the top, like a pergola, and then they put a kind of a false roof to add a little bit of a pitch, and then another roof over the top. So if there's any condensation, it comes through and then slopes away. It's kind of hard to describe over the radio, but there are ways to go ahead and put a small lightweight roof with a little bit of slope, like maybe even a fiberglass one over the top of your deck. That's going to help some of the snow. Of course, you're still going to get snow blowing in the sides, but I wouldn't really want to tie that roof into the roof of your house if your footings for your deck don't go down and into the ground to prevent frost upheaval.
Yeah, I don't know how far they're into the ground.
Yeah, whoever put it on, they'll be able to tell you. They should be able to. And if not, in a lot of cases, if it's a few feet off the ground, it's not that hard to go ahead and do it now. I mean, it really isn't that hard. You can go ahead and prop up the deck, take off what's holding it right now, and then go down in the ground and put a post in and hold the deck up and go from one post to one post. So it's not like you can't do it. It isn't that hard. Then you can go ahead and tie it into the house.
Is this something you hear from people a lot, Bill, that they built a deck and now it's a miserable place to
be? Yeah. I've done the same thing. I've got a deck and it's underneath the walnut trees. And I tell you what, you want to see something slick. You go out there when all the walnuts have fallen down, or in the rain, I get the slime build up. And then I have this great hydroponic system. I only have one little gutter on the house, and that catches a bunch of walnuts. And I don't like cleaning gutters. So at the end of the summer, I have where the walnuts have grown up. So I have 8, 10
nursery.
Yeah, hydroponic walnut nursery, because I'm too lazy to clean that gutter. And then you ask me, how do we do it?
Right.
I don't. That's
very, very low maintenance.
Yes.
So before you build a deck, how do you know if it's going to be pleasant?
Well, that's it. If it is going to be facing west, usually they're not that great, because unless you've got a lot of shading, and that's, that's the key. You want to really think of the whole process, because if you're going to have a deck, then you may want to think of, okay, let's put a kind of a shading trellis design on the west side of the deck to help shade the sun from getting onto the deck and make it, you know, something that ties into the design. Or plant some, you know, some, not, of course, not ash now, but, you know, plant some good deciduous trees that you know, will shade it. Or, you know, if you want, if you've got the time, put some evergreens there. And then you've also, you know, put them at the right distance. You've got a windbreak. And, you know, it all kind of, one little thing, then all of a sudden you've got all these other little steps to think about. But it's the darker colors of those decks that are really, really hot. You know, those dark browns, dark greens, wow. I mean, they're about blister your feet. And they've had a lot of problems with them in the southeast, like in the Carolinas, I know. So,
I'm talking with home improvement expert Bill McAnally. He's answering your questions about decks or anything else that's going on with your house or any home improvement projects that you're planning. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or post on our Facebook page. Next up is Jane in Beaverdale. Hi, Jane.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Not deck related. I was wondering, what do you think of moisture reader meters that you can detect moisture in a wall, an interior wall? And the origins of my question are, I live in the Beaverdale area, typical 1.5 story.
Mm-hmm.
There is a remodeled bathroom upstairs, which appears to be quite nice, but obviously it was done post. And so today we hear a drip in the wall on the main floor, but I see no evidence of leaking, but it's always bothered me. So I can hear it going down the pipes, the waters
okay.
from the shower or the sink or the stool. But for some reason, I feel like I'm hearing an extra drip that's concerning me, and yet there's no physical evidence that anything is getting worse when I look up at the ceiling or the walls.
Okay. Is it plastic pipe?
I don't know. I'm going to assume so. It was probably done about 10 years ago.
Okay. It probably is. And this is just something that it may be because it's happened to us in the past. Is plastic pipe expands and contracts when you run water through it from, you know, because it's like at room temperature, then you put hot water or cold water in it. The plastic will move. And if the plastic pipe is set against wood, like it usually is, it'll make this tick 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 noise, and you swear it's dripping, but it's actually the pipe rubbing up against the wood, and just making that same sound as a drip. And does it quit after a little while?
It does.
Yeah.
It begins regardless of which bathroom item is being used: the shower, the sink. And it just sounds so obvious, yet I don't believe there's any. We have plaster walls, and there's no defect that's
appearing. You know what? I bet that's what it is, because we learned that really fast when we were building houses. The customers call and say, how come I hear this ticking noise? And it's just because we were cutting the holes too small for the plastic pipe. We didn't know that's what it did. And so you can eat, you know, and if you don't see any moisture or any issues, you know, because this time, like right now, it shouldn't be happening unless you're getting a whole lot of rain. But you should be seeing some water. And if it quits, that's what makes me think, well, it's not the rain. So I bet it's just the pipe rubbing against the wood.
Do you think that we would, after 10 years of living here, 12 years, we would see evidence if it was truly leaking? Or could it actually manifest for a long time?
It could, but, you know, if you're not seeing anything after 10 years, it's been doing it the whole time.
Sorry.
Has it been, you know, ticking like the whole time?
Yes.
It's probably that. But you can get moisture sensors. You know, most of the hardware stores carry them, and they are fairly accurate. I wouldn't get the bottom priced one. But if you have someone that does, like, say, furniture or cabinet making, just go borrow one. And then you can do some probes. You can read the manual, though, because you can get some really weird readings if you don't know what you're looking at. But I'd be, you know, just borrow one. But I bet that's what it is.
How does it feel to give good news for once?
Hey, finally, yeah.
Jane, thanks a lot for your call. Next up is Rex in Des Moines. Hi, Rex.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, it goes back to this three-season porch idea. My question is, are they worth it in terms of how much time we'd actually get out of it in Iowa? And also, what I could expect is sort of a baseline for cost per foot.
Well, that's a good, you know, that's a good question. You're going to have to get a contractor to give you a price on it, because if I ever gave you an estimate, what's that guy thinking? You know, because it really depends on what kind of structure you're going to be building and what kind of windows you're going to be putting in, because a lot of people will go ahead and they'll put in, you know, a high level window, because they're thinking, okay, it's three seasons. Some people's three seasons idea is they will put heat in there just for those halfway decent days in the winter, you know, and some will consider a three season. Well, when it gets to be like, say, 45 degrees, I'm never going out there again. That's where the cost really difference is your flooring. Okay. For one thing, because a lot of times they'll put ceramic tile out there or laminate wood, you know, probably not carpet. And then it depends if they're going to insulate that underneath. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. So you'll want to get a plan put together, Rex, first, and then take it somewhere and have someone give you an estimate. But really, really think about that, because if you think you may want to eventually use that, you know, year round, then, you know, bite the bullet at the time, get some, you know, good windows, and make sure that the walls, you know, are insulated, and make sure that, you know, the floor is insulated correctly. So it's easy to do it now as of later, because it seems like that's square footage that you're going to keep looking at and think, man, I'd really like to sit out there even in the winter. And there are some really nice mini split heat pumps that will heat and cool that. They kind of they mount on the wall on the outside. Just ask your heating and cooling person for a mini split heat pump, and that would be a very nice system for that if you did decide to heat and cool it.
All right, and if it's really nice, then it probably adds to the value of the home, right?
It does. That will add a lot to the house.
All right, Rex, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. Bill McAnally is here to answer your home improvement questions. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. I'm here with home improvement expert Bill McAnally, here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. And Fred is on the line next from Grinnell. Hi, Fred.
Hey there. Regarding the house that was built in 64,
okay,
cement blocks. We put a cement slab on the north side of the house. There's a bit of a slope toward the house. There was a little water penetration in the basement before. It has gotten no better. We didn't put a 3-foot deep footing on that north side of the concrete slab.
Okay.
What would be the best thing to do to stop the penetration?
Well, you know, probably the easiest thing – well, not the easiest thing, but the most permanent thing to do is in Grinnell and around your area, I know there's someone that does mud jacking where they'll come in and they'll pump a slurry underneath that slab, and then it will raise it so it can slope away from the house. And that'll, you know, that takes care of about 90% of it. You think most of it's coming from that slab? You mean as
a slab, because there's a bit of a
– because it goes towards the house.
Toward the house,
yeah.
Right.
You think that's where most of the water's coming from, or is the yard kind of sloping that way as well?
Well, it's a gravel up that way. It's not like it's, you know, 300-400 feet. It's only maybe 75 feet.
Okay.
And it just there's always a water in the basement. We had that rain several weeks ago, 4 or 5 inches, and there was enough in there. You had to use the squeegee on the floor to try to get rid of it. So if I put a tile down, say a foot and a half or 2 feet, with some pea gravel in it, and it slopes to the west, so that there would be a good drainage flow, you know, out toward the septic tank.
Right.
Would that be?
You know, that may help. What a lot of the guys are doing, and they haven't done it until this last few years, is they're going out against some of that rubber membrane, like pond liner, and they're digging down, say, maybe a foot into the ground, and then they're attaching that pond liner, caulking, and then they're using that metal strapping that you would screws right into the concrete block that holds the rubber membrane tight and is caulked so that it's waterproof, and then they're putting that out maybe 5 feet, and then putting gravel and tile over the top so it catches it before it goes into the old overdig of the house, and then they slope that as well, so they kind of take the ground down about a foot, and they angle that soil the way you want to go. and basically you turning it into kind of a big French drain, something that a lot of towns are putting underneath their streets is when the water goes through the street and they're using the soil to take it away. That, you know, that can work. You don't have to go down a foot, maybe 6 inches, but, you know, that will catch a lot of that water as well. And but, you know, our old concrete blocks, I used to lay concrete block foundations all the time. It just seems like, you know, when we built those, especially the 60s and 70s, we put on a parge coat, and then we put on what we thought was waterproofing. It was just some stuff that seemed to fall off after a couple of years. And concrete blocks are very porous. You know, they do crack. And in some of them, even in my mom's that I laid, we have a corner that's bad. And so what I did is I just tapped a hole into the bottom course of the concrete block to relieve the pressure. And letting the water comes flowing and it goes right to it. Luckily, there's a floor drain there. That was by accident. But that, you know, takes that water away at that point. You know, you can always look at beaver systems and things like that, which is basically a tile that attaches on the inside. They're only about 6 inches tall and 2 inches deep that are caulked to the floor and the wall. It'll catch the water from seeping. But, you know, I'd start with the outside stuff first. And go that route, and that may work for you, but I'd still get that slab mud jacked, and usually they're a lot of times listed in the yellow pages, but if you call your say I don't know who does your ready mix around there in that area, but you know, call them, and a lot of times they will tell you who will be a mud jacking contractor, and then at least that'll take a lot of that water away, and then you can caulk the seam between the slab and the house.
All right, Fred, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, Nancy's on the line in Adel. Hi, Nancy.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm not building a deck.
Okay.
My question is, what happened with our windows in January when February, when it was so cold and was terrific condensation, every
yep.
single window in this house? I mean,
yep.
it was like a flood. So my question is, now my sister had the same problem with her cabin in northern Minnesota, and she put in an air exchanger.
Sure.
And she said that has more or less solved her problem. But we're so far south of that, I wondered, is that necessary here? Or if I just exchange windows, get better windows, because these are not good windows. The frost even came through the wood by the windows.
Yeah.
I could see frost.
Or
is it a combination? Or just what can be done with that terrible condensation?
Well, there's a lot of things going on with the condensation. You know, windows can only do so well, and maybe the windows aren't all that great, but you know, the thing is, it's usually the failures are it's not the glass per se, it's
mm-hmm.
everything around it, the sash and everything.
Yeah, it's the sash.
Yeah, it's a sash. So with the heat exchanger, everything that I've ever done since '70s, every project's had a heat recovery ventilation system in it, which is an air-to-air heat exchanger. And what that does is it draws drier air in from outside and takes the higher moisture air from inside, takes it out, and mm-hmm. dries your house down. Now, if
mm-hmm.
you have a humidifier going if you have, if you do a lot of cooking and that kitchen exhaust isn't directed outside from a range hood, or if you don't have bathroom vents, if you have a moisture level, say, in the 40%, 45%, 50% in some houses, it depends on the windows, of course, you're going to have a tremendous amount of moisture. And then if you close your blinds at night, that's even worse, because the air from your heating and cooling system can't wash across the glass and take that excess moisture away. Do you have radiant heat, like electric heat, or?
No.
Okay. I wouldn't spend the money on the windows. Windows are very hard to justify, no matter what you see in the ads and everything. New windows are really hard to justify in an existing home for energy efficiency. Try to dry the house down first. You know, go to a store, hardware store, and get a humidistat so that you can see what the relative humidity is inside the house. But we also don't want to get it too dry in the winter, because then you tend to pick up more health issues because the air is too dry. When you start really zapping, you know, big electric bolts off your finger in the winter, it's probably too low of moisture content, but you still may get moisture on your windows depending on, you know, the quality of them. But every house should have ventilation anyway. So does your, you know, look at that. Do my bathroom vent fans go outside, not just into my attic? Do they go outside? Do I have a range hood that vents outside? Do I have a humidifier? If you're running a humidifier in a window, a lot of times it may be too high. But the thing that's going to tell you this is the amount of moisture on your windows and that humidistat. The humidistat's going to tell you what that number is, what the percentage is. And, yeah, like I say, you know, we keep new houses. We try to keep them, even in the winter, like, say, 40 to 43%. But we know that we can't really shut the window treatments all the way down because there will be moisture there when it's this cold. I mean, that's it. And really, technically, when we have really cold, like, say, below zero weather, you'd better have a little bit of moisture on your windows. Otherwise, you don't have enough moisture in your house.
All right.
So it's just something we have to live with in Iowa. But, yeah, I would recommend first, you know, take a look at the bathroom vent fans and the range hood and the humidifier thing and the humidistat. And then what I like is a heat recovery ventilator if you're in northern Iowa.
All right. Nancy, thank you so much for your call. Next up, Jim and Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Hey. I used to build those decks back when we didn't know a darn thing, and just about anybody with a hammer could do it. People need to be very cautious. I had a family member that was badly injured when a deck collapsed with too many people. And there was a hibachi and a lot of weight and a lot of broken bones and burning things like that happening. So,
Yep.
And go out and look at your deck before you throw a party and make sure that it's up to snuff.
You know, I just want to say because you're exactly right, Jim, and it seems like where the deck failure, a lot of the pictures when you look at deck failures is it pulls away from the house a little bit, and then that falls down and people get pinched between the deck and the house. And there was that one out east, and you probably saw the same picture. I forget how many people were seriously injured in that, where it, you know, like you say, the barbecue and all that. But, yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. I just wanted to reinforce that.
People need to realize that. And, you know, they start drinking and bouncing to the music, and 10 people is like 100 now.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But, yeah, it's scary stuff. And, you know, you need to realize just because you're out in the country doesn't mean anything's different.
And did you have a question, too, Jim?
Yep, I did. I was wondering if Bill had any good suggestions on how to locate a sneaky leak in your roof. If you happen to have any good pointers on how to go about finding a leak that you just can't seem to find.
Well, you know, and you've probably tried this already, but, you know, a lot of times it's just the garden hose starting, really taking your time working your way up from the bottom a foot at a time. But they're so hard to find on those roofs, you know, because, and I know that's what you're thinking, is all of a sudden it'll travel left or right for some reason, and then it'll get on a floor joist, and then it'll come down and catch the seam of a plywood and go over another bay. So the last insurance adjuster I was talking with is they have been using a fully qualified and certified and very well-trained person with infrared cameras, because you can find leaks with that, but what people have to remember, there has to be that temperature difference. And so sometimes they will use a garden hose and the water coming out of that is at 50, and they try to do it 50 degrees, and they try to do it on a very warm day where the roof may be 100 degrees. And so then they can possibly see that. But, yeah, sometimes those really sneaky ones like that, I swear they'll go 10 feet to the right and then come down. And they are hard to find unless you're either in the attic and then running water over it, or in a persistent rain like maybe what we're having now. But that's why some of them are jumping to using infrared camera. But, I mean, if they haven't gone to basically a week-long training, very seldom do they really know how to run and know what they're seeing in that camera. And I know that's – you probably wanted me to find a better answer for you, Jim, but that's about as good as I can get you.
All right, Jim, thanks a lot for
thanks,
your call.
Jim.
Next up, Laura in Iowa City. Hi, Laura.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my question today. Some types of composite deck material have problems with mildew buildup, especially if the deck is located on the north or east side of the house.
Yeah.
Mildew sometimes forms inside the composite deck material and is impossible to clean. My question here is there a composite or plastic deck material that does not have this propensity to cause mildew growth on it, either its exterior or interior? And additionally, what would a homeowner spec out for a composite deck material that would avoid this issue?
You know, I think that's another good point that you're bringing up. But, you know, it really depends where you're building that deck, because if it is shady or if you get a lot of moisture on it, you are going to get the mold buildup, because the composite does have some wood fibers in it. And it, that brings up a really good point, because when you have wood and you get moisture, you get mold. And so that's why, you know, we have had some issues with some of these man-made products. And in areas where you know, you may have that propensity towards mold, you may want to maybe, you know, skip towards more of a, you know, wood-free plastic type decking. And some of them look exactly like the composites. But we've put some down on houses when I was still at Iowa Central that, you know, the interlocking plastic ones. And wow, those are – I mean, they still look like new, and that was in the mid-90s. The only downside is I think sometimes they have a – they just can't quite take impacts, like maybe a huge, you know, hailstone, which that – or somebody drops something. And that may be an issue. But that may be, in your case, the only place to go, because I don't think you're going to be able to do anything with it to stop it. And that's why some of the companies have gone out of business, I think, is because they have had issues inside the product and not only on the top. That's a really good question. So people need to think about there again. Am I on the west? Am I underneath trees? Do I have a lot of moisture? And right. That's going to dictate what you're going to use.
All right. Just like you should have thought about, right?
Yes. But... yeah. Yeah. Hey, if you need walnuts, I'm the guy.
All right. Here's a question from Facebook. We have a decked area that I'm pretty sure is just sitting on the ground. We'd like to remove it and replace it with an inexpensive patio material. What suggestions for material for that new patio do you have? I was wondering about a pea gravel patio.
I was just going to say, my dad was super cheap, so he probably would have just thrown some gravel, went him over to the neighbor's driveway and scooped some up with a wheelbarrow at 3 in the morning or something, you know. P-Rock, it kind of reminds me of what you see out in Denver. I personally wouldn't ever maybe do that. I would maybe go step up and find – maybe go to a Habitat Restore or something like that, find some repurposed bricks or patio pavers, you know. Do something other than just the rock. And because if you just have the rock, and it's funny, we were talking a break about cats. If you just have pea rock, it's not the best thing to have if there's critters around and you're constantly tracking. And plus the other, you know, the other thing is it is hard to keep from inside the house. And when you drag – when that pea
and
rock –
And to keep in the place where you've put it.
Yeah, keep it in the place where you put it. And the last thing you want to do is come walking in and somebody has some boots on, like say hiking boots, and you get a piece of P-Rock in there, and all of a sudden you're skidding across somebody's laminate floor or their ceramic tile, or getting it stuck in the weather stripping on the bottom of the door. So I would kind of maybe make a move up. You're in my dad's heart right there, I can tell, but you're going to maybe have to go up in one more layer.
And if you do pea gravel, you at least want a border around it, right?
Yeah. You don't want it just kind of going all over the place. No.
All right. No. And final question from email. We're working on building a new house later in the spring. We were planning on a ranch walkout with a pergola on the deck over the walkout. Do you have any structural advice given the addition of the pergola? We were also going to try to encourage a vine to grow on it, like wisteria. Can that cause any additional issues?
It can if it's wood, but you know, if that's what you want, that's okay. But I would really look at that prescriptive guide, because that does also cover on, you know, what you're going to have to do structurally if you're going to have some uprights. Everybody should be following that code no matter where it is, because remember, codes are minimums; they're basic minimums. So, and when you do put a pergola up, and then you maybe want to put some extra growing on it, that may add wherever you're at. They may add some wind loads, and then you're also going to be dealing with moisture then, because that plant is going to hold it, and if it starts crawling in between your decking boards, then you could have, maybe premature deck failure.
All right. Well, Bill McAnally, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks. You betcha. Thanks.
Sorry we ran out of time. We had a lot of people with a lot more questions, so they'll ask those questions maybe when you come back next month.
Okay.
Talk of Iowa was produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. With me now is Ben Kiefer, host of River to River. Hello, Ben.
Hi, Charity. Today at noon, we are going to pull back the curtain on emergency room costs. So find out where those big bills come from. And this is the third in our installment over ER costs. For instance, we'll have a man tell us today about a rabies vaccination he had done at the ER, which ended up costing $24,000. Wow. So we'll find out what's behind that and find out how the Affordable Care Act will be affecting emergency room costs as well. Charity.
All right. River to River today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.